fact Stony Man had contacts in every nook and crevice of the world wasn't more evident than when the men of Phoenix Force arrived on the French island of Belle-Île-en-Mer. Grimaldi had managed to get them into Belle-Île-en-Mer airfield near Quiberon, and an island resident, a retired American who used to work for the Pentagon, shuttled them to the home of a friend who had a boat rental company. The man's house sat on stilts above the waters of the marina, and beneath the house was a makeshift dock. The Frenchman pulled back a massive tarpaulin to reveal two large speedboats. They were sleek and polished, with powerful engines built into the aft sections. The boats were powerful enough to require twin exhaust pipes out the back. At first viewing, the eyes of most of the Phoenix Force warriors popped from their heads.
Oh, my American friends, these are the finest boats on the island. They're very fast and quite dependable. I think you'll have no problem.
Do you have any idea what we want them for?
The man looked uncertainly at Phoenix Force's liaison, an overweight bear of a man named Grabowski.
He doesn't know and he doesn't need to know. Your people already compensated him well.
Good, because I can't guarantee what sort of condition he'll get them back in.
Oh, not to worry, sir. My friend Grabowski is correct. I have been paid more than enough to replace them if they are not returned in good shape.
They may not be returned at all, pal.
Mr. Smith, you'll pilot this boat. Mr. Gomez, you take the other.
Inciso nodded and went to it, with James taking the other. McCarter shook hands with the Frenchman and Grabowski, then dropped into the boat piloted by Inciso. Manning was on board with him, while Hawkins boarded with James. As they powered smoothly out of the marina, keeping their speed low to avoid attracting the attention of police patrol boats, McCarter looked over Manning's shoulder as the Canadian continually monitored the progress of the freighter.
Where is it?
Close. We almost missed them.
Well, these boats seem pretty bloody fast to me, mate. We ought to be able to catch up with them quickly.
It's not catching up with them that has me worried. It's what we do once we get there.
What do you mean?
Well, it's safe to assume we'll run into the same level of resistance as we did before. There won't be any second chances on this one. And that blockade is getting close, too. We can only hope they'll hold back until we've had a chance to neutralize the threat.
Well, it's like I told you before, Mike. We can't worry about the political ramifications. We need to shut this thing down any way we can. It's no rules now. We're gonna have to hit them and hit them hard. This one counts like it's never counted before.
As soon as the powerboats had cleared the no-wake zone of the marina, Inciso threw the boat into high gear and opened the throttle full. Short of the Frenchman's promise, the boats accelerated and began cruising across the water, bouncing through the choppier parts with their noses pointed skyward at nearly a 45-degree angle. McCarter felt the rush of sea air against his face, and the saltiness stung his eyes, causing them to water. After about 20 minutes, they could make out the freighter's distinct lines on the horizon. They would be within striking range in about 5 minutes. A quick survey of the area revealed the British blockade was nowhere to be seen, which meant that they were just ahead of the game. McCarter double-checked the action of his 9mm Browning high-power pistol secured in the shoulder leather beneath his left armpit, then brought the MP5 into battery. Manning had already turned to a similar procedure, first checking Inciso's weapon for him and passing it to the Cuban with a nod of assurance, then attending to his own weapon. For this encounter, he'd brought an extra bit of firepower, packed in the Fabrique Nationale FAL battle rifle. A rugged, dependable weapon, it had long been a popular choice among the members of Stony Man for various reasons. The Belgian-made assault rifle was chambered to fire the heavy 7.62mm NATO round and was probably one of the most successfully designed rifles in small arms manufacturing history. A product of its time with distribution in over 55 countries, the FNFAL was extremely rugged, reliable under the most stringent conditions, and could dispense its heavy caliber slugs at a muzzle velocity exceeding 850 meters per second. Manning at first developed his tremendous respect for the weapon while serving as an RCMP officer.
White Lightning to White 4.
White 4 here.
You guys pull ahead. Put as much heat on them as you can, mate, so we can find a way aboard.
Roger Wilco, White Lightning.
White Lightning out here. Get ready.
Before they had even reached the freighter, they could see muzzle flashes winking from the railings. At least 10 terrorists were standing at the portside rail near the bow of the ship and putting out a heavy firestorm of lead.
Return fire!
McCarter and Manning opened up with their assault weapons in reaction, actually knocking a couple of the terrorists out on their first pass. At the last moment before they reached the bow, Enciso cut a hard right and headed for the starboard side while James continued on a straight course. Enciso traversed the entire starboard side looking for an opening, then moved past the wake of the freighter before making a hard turn and heading back toward the boat. There were a few ladder rungs built into the side of this particular vessel, which the team could use when they decided to storm the ship. It looked as if Enciso was about to make another complete run when suddenly he stopped the engine and brought the boat clanking roughly against the side of the freighter, the nose just coming to rest below an access ladder.
All right, Lego, hey, watch it!
Oh, sorry. I'm trying to keep her steady. Just keep on a good hold.
Manning dismissed the irritation and vaulted up the ladder, McCarter right on his heels. Enciso moored the boat against the freighter by tying off a good, strong knot against the lowest ladder rung, then put his foot up to climb. Enciso quickly located the source of the sound and found himself in the gun sights of a Qibla terrorist on the deck. In a moment frozen in time, Rafael Enciso could see the terrorist's smile behind the rifle as his finger began to tighten on the trigger.
Caribbean Ocean.
Carl Lyons yanked on his teammate's sleeves and dragged them down as a plethora of assault rifle fire buzzed over their heads like a swarm of angry hornets. Rosario Blancanales seemed to recover from the assault with the reaction of a seasoned pro. Even as Lyons watched with horrific realization, he knew he couldn't do anything to stop his crazy friend. It seemed like he watched Blancanales' finger curve around the trigger of the M203, but he couldn't do a thing. The grenade struck the wall just to the right of the terrorists. The corridor rocked with a blast, dust and gases expanding at a rate much faster than the narrow passageway could handle. Lyons shook his head to clear it, then he and Blancanales helped Schwartz get to his feet, as he'd been the closest to the blast and the one most exposed to its effects. Lyons immediately noted with concern the watery blood leaking from his friend's right ear. Schwartz noticed his friend looking at him and reached up his hand to come away with the sticky substance. Blancanales stepped over to him and quickly inspected his ear. After about a full minute, he slapped Schwartz on the back.
Thought maybe you ruptured an eardrum. Does it hurt?
Yeah.
Well, I'd suspect some trauma to the outer ear. I think the eardrum's still intact.
Good. And while I just hate to be the bearer of bad news, that missile's still intact too. We need to stop this now.
The three men agreed and turned to start for the cargo hold, but at the last second, they realized they wouldn't be able to safely pass through the smoke and flames left by Blancanales' handiwork.
Well, can't get there that way.
Now what?
Hey, if they're opening that top hatch, we could go back the way we came and access it from there. I can put that launch pad out of commission easily with one well-placed grenade.
No way, no how. We can't risk exposing ourselves to the chemical loaded in that warhead. Not to mention the fact that the top deck of this freighter is probably crawling with terrorists. We'll have to find another way to the cargo hold.
Let's go the other way, then.
The men set off with Blancanales on point, Schwartz in the center, and Lyons on rear guard. The numbers were ticking off, and it wouldn't be long before the missile was in position. With Schwartz guiding their movements, Blancanales led them down the corridors, and they descended several flights of steps before eventually reaching the lowest deck. From that point, they would enter the cargo area at its base, and by that time, they would probably have only a few minutes at most to put a stop to the launch.
Listen.
What?
The thrumming. It stopped. The missile's in position.
They pressed onward, more determined than ever to make sure the missile didn't get off the ship. As they neared the turn that would take them down the corridor and into the cargo bay, Blancanales halted, and the three men took to a knee.
How do you want to do it?
Gadgets will go for the controls to the pad. He's the one most likely to understand them. They'll probably be well guarded, so you and I are going to have to run interference. We'll go through the door first and clear out the force. Gadgets, that should give you enough room to get to the controls and do your magic. Questions?
There were none.
All right, boys. Let's nut up and do it.
Lyons and Blancanales rounded the corner and trotted down the hatchway. They could only hope it wasn't barred from the inside. Provided they'd created enough of a distraction for the terrorists, the Qibla gunners probably wouldn't have noticed the door being secure or not. All focus would now be on getting the missile launched, and nobody would have likely worried about one little detail like that. Lyons reached forward and moved the circular hatch lock. It turned freely. Their luck had held out. On a three count, the two able team warriors went through the door, weapons held at the ready. Four surprised terrorists to their right were in no position to react to the battle-hardened speed and accuracy of the able team pair.
Iron Man, get down!
Ugh. Torch tossed his friend a salute, then sprinted for the control panel on the other side of the launch pad. There were no more terrorists visible in the cargo bay, which didn't seem good to Lyons' way of thinking. The rest had been cleared out, with only a small force left behind to guard the missile from sabotage. Steam had already begun to spit from the base of the missile, pouring forth in pressurized bursts. Schwartz joined his teammate a minute later.
I can't stop it!
What do you mean you can't stop it?
They've locked me out of the system! They must have triggered it from a remote station!
Or the breach. Better than nothing. Come on!
Don't think it's gonna matter now.
10.
This whole place is gonna fill with superheated gases!
9.
Move!
The three men rushed for the hatch they had
8.
Come through, what they knew would be their only chance for
7.
Survival. There was no safe spot anywhere
6.
In the chamber. Even if they weren't exposed
5.
Directly to the accelerant, they could sure as hell be
4.
Scalded to death by the high-pressure carbon dioxide
3.
Sprayed from high-pressure
2.
Ports to cool the launch pad and bay.
1.
As the three men dived through the hatch one behind the other, the corridor shook with a frightening force, and the noise was deafening in the combined space.
Get away from the door!
They continued sprinting until they were at a safe distance. The three men threw themselves to the deck, sweat soaking their hair and black suits. They didn't want to say it. Nobody needed to say it. The terrorists had succeeded in launching the missile, and Able Team had proved ineffective in stopping them.
We've got a failsafe.
Send a signal, Wizard.
Schwartz reached to his belt and retrieved the small black box with a hinged door. He snapped a small plastic lock from the box to break the seal, extended an antenna set into the top of it, opened the hinged door, and pressed a single orange button inside. The little device was the brainchild of Huntington Weathers. At that moment, it was designed to send a special frequency coded only to be receivable by the Stony Man satellite. That signal would then bounce to the Stony Man computers and initiate a sequence to alert Grognola that it was red phone time.
It's done.
Yeah, I guess it's in the hands of the Air Force now. What's wrong with you, Carl? I made a promise to Hal that we'd stop this thing. Now, because I couldn't do my job, a hell of a lot of Americans might die today. All because I failed. You didn't fail anything, my friend. If there was any failure, we all contributed to it. Our flyboys there in Florida are the best in the world. They'll put that missile down. You wait and see.
Snap out of it, Iron Man. We've got a freighter full of terrorists to stop.
A very hard and very dangerous expression crossed Lyons' face.
Uh-oh. I've seen that look before, and it's never good.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
I don't know about you two, but I've had enough of these bastards. If a lot of innocent Americans die today, then there'll be an equal number of the enemy going down with them. So, yeah, Gadgets, you're right. We still have a boatload of terrorists to kill, and I say we get to it.
With the snap of his wrists, Lyons brought the MP5s into readiness. His teammates slowly got to their feet. They were instilled by the confidence and fury of their friend, and they began to psych themselves up in the same way. If the Qibla terrorists tried to take their lives, that was one thing. They had signed up for that possibility. But the thousands of Americans they threatened were just ordinary people who went about their ordinary days. They hadn't done anything to anyone. They were just trying to make it in a hard, cold world.
I'm with you.
Ditto.
Lyons whirled and went to the door. He touched it to ensure it was cool, then spun the handle and opened the hatch. He walked purposefully across the launch pad, obscured by the smoke left in the wake of the missile's departure. They were about to pay dearly for that cheering. Lyons hoped they were enjoying themselves, having a good time and patting one another on the back, because he and his two friends were about to send them to hell. Lyons reached a stairwell that stretched from the bottom of the cargo hold to the lip of the top deck. He took the stairs three at a time, his teammates close on his heels. A dozen or so gunners stood directly in his path. Lyons raised the pair of machine pistols and opened fire. Lunkinalis and Schwartz emerged from the pit to take flanking positions. Schwartz leveled the Beretta at a group of five terrorists who had watched the missile launch. The SIG 551 sped a vicious fusillade of 5.56mm NATO rounds, cutting through the bellies and arms of the terrormongers before even those who were armed could bring their weapons to bear. Lunkinalis began his offensive by flipping out the rangefinder sight of the M203, acquiring the center window of the bridge as his target, and squeezing the trigger. He slammed home a second round, this one incendiary, and aimed it through the gaping crater left in the front of the bridge tower by the first grenade. On a roll, Bacchanalis leveled the M16 to take out two terrorists he spotted charging through the smoke, their rifles up and ready. The other's heart exploded from the impact as the rounds turned the better part of his chest cavity into little more than a bloody pulp. Lyon slung the two machine pistols, then rolled from where he stood in time to avoid being shot through the ribs by a terrorist charging him with an Uzi blazing on full auto. He came out of the roll while simultaneously drawing his .357 Magnum Colt Python from shoulder leather.
Gadget, cover paw!
The grenade struck the chest of one of the terrorists who was apparently leading the charge. And the after effects were devastating. The explosive force blew him apart, spontaneously separating all four of his appendages, while the blast sent shockwaves through those near his position. Eardrums broke, eyes popped from sockets, and a number of the terrorists went down with their clothes on fire. The few terrorists still alive were thrown to the deck. Lyons and Schwartz made short work of them. Smoke and steam continued to sweep across the deck, and the smell of burned human flesh was in the air as small fires consumed the flesh and blood and bone of dead bodies. The Able Team trio waited nearly a full minute for further threats to appear, but none did. They were getting to their feet when a sound somewhere from behind and below them caused all to turn with freshly charged weapons ready for more. The trio watched as a boat raced in the direction of Cancun. Someone was escaping from the freighter, most likely the terrorist leader responsible for this atrocity, and perhaps even for the launching of the missile.
Oh, fuck no. There's no way I'm letting anyone get away.
And before either of his partners could offer any kind of sensible protest, Carl Lyons dove over the aft railing of the freighter.
Bay of Biscay, North Atlantic.
Raphael Enciso had undergone too many near-death experiences to say that he still saw his life flash before his eyes. But the flashes he had expected to see milliseconds before the terrorists' bullets smashed through his mortal body never came. At least, not in the way he expected. Instead, the flashes of light he saw were sparks ricocheting off the iron edge of the freighter deck, then shooting upward to punch into the terrorist's form. The terrorist's body went into convulsions as chunks of flesh were ripped away from his torso. The dance ended with his head exploding, a gory spray of blood and gray matter. Enciso barely had time to catch a glimpse of the familiar symbol of the British flag before the chopper disappeared from view. He shook his head, not sure what had really happened, but glad that it had, and continued to follow his teammates up the exterior ladder rungs set into the freighter's side. By the time Enciso had reached the lip of the freighter, the battle had already been joined by his colleagues. McCarter raised his MP5 and cut a corkscrew burst through a nearby trio of terrorists, apparently more intent on cutting him down than on planning for their own survival. Above the din of the hot zone came the unforgettable sound of the FNFAL as Manning took care of business all along the deck of the freighter. Enciso knelt and helped his teammates clear the deck. Enciso's eyes roamed across the deck, but he didn't see the source of the shooting. He let his gaze move upward and found the target. Somebody was firing from the catwalk encircling the bridge tower. Enciso rotated the stock of the FNC into an open and locked position, then lifted the rifle to his shoulder. He aligned the target in the tritium-painted iron sights and squeezed the trigger. The 5.56mm NATO round punched through the terrorist's jaw and ripped away the better part of his lower face. His head snapped backward, and the impact slammed him against the front of a bridge window. Enciso turned to Manning. He gestured in the general area of where the missile was being kept.
Go! We'll cover you!
The big Canadian nodded, dropped another terrorist coming at him from the left, then burst from his spot and headed for the nearest hatchway that would lead him below decks. Enciso turned and looked until he spotted the chopper. It was a Lynx MK-8, the same kind that had saved his hide less than a minute earlier, and it looked as if the pilot was about to make another pass. Enciso whirled to locate McCarter.
Get down!
The fox-faced Briton tossed him a salute before hitting the deck. Enciso joined him and pressed his face tightly against the cold iron plating. The terrorists thought their enemies were surrendering, and they were apparently oblivious to their surroundings. A number of them broke cover and rushed to take their prey, paying no heed that a chopper was bearing down on them. The results were disastrous. The surface of the deck turned into a wash of red as terrorist after terrorist fell to the merciless onslaught. As the chopper ceased firing and buzzed by them, Enciso lifted his head in time to see McCarter deliver some kind of special salute. The pilot obviously recognized the gesture, and it solidified his place as an ally and not a terrorist in their mind. The deck was silent, almost as silent as a cemetery, as the chopper departed. Enciso had never seen anything quite like it before, but he imagined in some ways it might have looked something like this on the decks of the Higgins boats in the aftermath of the Normandy invasions. McCarter quickly joined him.
Snap out of it, mate. We need to secure this ship and quick. Head for the bridge, but wait for me to join you before assaulting it.
Where are you going?
Well, someone has to make sure Carol and TJ don't get their bloody heads shot off when coming on board.
It took no more than a few minutes for Manning to find a hatch that would get him to the lower decks. As he proceeded for his target, he considered the fact that it didn't seem this boat had been populated by nearly as many terrorists as the other. Not that it mattered. The important thing was that he neutralized the missile, and he'd have to do it quickly.
Cancun, Mexico.
Carl Lyons managed to catch up to the motor launch as it docked at a small marina on the outskirts of the city. The Able Team warrior felt odd having left his companions behind, but he couldn't worry about that now. This was between Lyons and whoever he was pursuing. Whoever had escaped the freighter was probably responsible for launching the missile, and quite possibly a high-ranking official in the Qibla terror group. Lyons couldn't be certain, but it was possible he was chasing Jabir al-Warik or Mohamed Temez. If that was true, he would have been negligent not to pursue them. As he neared the boat, Lyons saw the reflection of light on metal. He turned a sharp right, saving his life. Somebody was lying prone in the motor launch and trying to gun him down. Obviously, it wasn't a skilled sniper he was dealing with, because whoever was shooting at him didn't know the first thing about the importance of cover and concealment, or of making sure to hit the target with the first shot. Lyons started to move the boat away from the motor launch, but then thought better of it. He had learned a long time ago that sometimes the most effective move against an enemy was the one they least expected. Lyons kicked the motor into high gear and rushed the motor launch. The sniper was startled, jumping to his feet and shooting at the raft in hopes of deflating it before his opponent could reach him. The tactic didn't work because Lyons was just too close. Seconds before impact, the blonde warrior bailed from the vessel. The raft smacked into the motor launch, its bow catching on a sharp edge. The outboard motor continued forward, and the rubber raft acted as a slingshot, propelling the heavy engine out of the water. The majority of the weight was built into the top of the engine, which caused it to flip as it rocketed through the air, making the sharp, exposed blades the head of the grisly missile. The terrorist turned to attempt escape, but it was too late. Lyons swam to the motor launch, pulled himself on board, and checked the interior for clues before quickly exiting to the dock area. He looked around and tried to pinpoint his quarry. The subject could have gone in one of three directions. Eliminating one of those as the boardwalk that led to the other boats in the marina left two choices. It wasn't much of a choice, as he knew that the remaining routes both led into the heart of the port of Cancun. Lyons was attempting to decide what his next move should be when a voice sounded behind him.
May I help you, sir?
Lyons whirled and reached instinctively for his pistol, but he came up short when he saw the inquirer was only about 5'2", with long dark hair and brilliant eyes. The cocoa-colored skin of the petite woman shone starkly against the noonday sun. The Able Team warrior wouldn't have guessed her to be a day over 19 if she was that. Lyons felt a little self-conscious about his appearance, but quickly dismissed it as egocentric.
I seem to be lost. I was following my friends in that boat.
He pointed to the wrecked launch and hoped she didn't take notice of its condition, not to mention the splattered gore from the now headless terrorist.
I see your friends. I get them a taxi. Can I get you a taxi, too?
I suppose, but I'm not sure how to get back to their hotel. I think they were playing a trick on me.
The woman just stood and stared at him for the longest time, and Lyons wasn't sure if she was trying to convince herself he was telling the truth, or figure out what she had done in a former life that would have caused her to have to be exposed to so many stupid people in this one.
I do not know, but you wait for Raoul to come back and he tell you. You seem to be all wet.
Yeah, I had a little accident. Fell out of the boat.
Well, I have fresh clothes. Very cheap. Just down here. You follow me?
Lyons gave it some thought, then shrugged and gestured for her to lead the way. He watched her backside appreciatively as she led him down to a building constructed with the traditional veranda-style architecture popular at one time in Mexico's history. Lyons followed her through the courtyard and into a small shop. He was surprised to discover the young and attractive woman was a dressmaker.
You shocked by what you see?
A little. A seamstress. Seems like a funny thing to do out here.
You think I'm funny?
No, I don't think you're funny. I said, I think it's funny that someone would need a seamstress in a marina.
Everyone comes to Consuela. Everyone needs clothes.
Listen, I'd love to stick around and chat with you some more, but if you have those clothes ready, I really need to get them and get going. When will this friend of yours that drives the cab be back?
You are a policeman, no?
No. What makes you think that?
I saw what you do to that man on the boat. I saw him shoot gun at you.
Well, actually, he was shooting bullets. Listen, I just need to find my friends.
Friends not shoot at each other?
Oh, yeah, well, my friends do.
Those are bad men that live here with my Raoul.
Who is this Raoul? Is he your husband?
Oh, no. Raoul is my brother. He is younger. I am oldest in my family.
How many brothers and sisters do you have?
No other, just Raoul. Here, white shorts and silk shirt. Are those bad men? Will they hurt my Raoul?
Yes, they're bad men. But I don't think they'll hurt him as long as he doesn't ask them any questions.
Oh, Raoul asks many questions. He is very friendly. All tourists like him.
Well, let's hope he's not feeling so chatty today, for his sake.
Who is this, Consuela?
Lyons whirled. He saw a young man, definitely younger than Consuela, standing there with his hands in his pockets. His hair was combed back, and he had a wide, flat nose and bushy eyebrows. The eyes were dark, a sensual dark like Consuela's, but assuming this was Raoul, that's where the family resemblance ended. Lyons relaxed a little and wished to himself people would stop sneaking up on him.
Who are you? And what are you doing with my sister?
I'm not doing anything with your sister. I'm just buying some clothes from her. How much do I owe you?
You keep those. Come back and buy more later when you clean.
Lyons didn't take offense. He probably did smell rank as hell. He focused his attention on Raoul.
You took some men somewhere just now in your taxi?
Si.
How many?
There were two.
Where did you take them?
At first, Raoul didn't answer, and Lyons was about to reach out and throttle him when he realized what the boy was really waiting for. Raoul was obviously an opportunist of the highest order, and he saw he had something of value to Lyons. Any way to make a buck off some information was the name of the game around here, and Lyons could understand it. The economy in this area was solely supported by tourism, which the government took a good part of in taxes, to say nothing of additional undeclared sums for bribing public officials and police officers whenever it proved most convenient and expedient. Lyons reached into his pocket and withdrew a handful of soaked cash. Raoul stared at his open palm as if Lyons were handing him Monopoly money, then snatched the cash and counted it before giving the answer.
They go to downtown. They were talking in strange language most of the time.
Lyons nodded. Arabic.
Take me to where you dropped them off. Listen, kid, you just took at least 60 bucks in American bills off me, so I think you've been compensated.
Okay, I take you. You want change clothes?
I'll change in a cab.
Oh, no, he not change in cab. Car half mine.
Dressing room?
Consuela and Raoul pointed simultaneously toward a room in the back.
So, but how long's Manning been down there? Not too long. Should be done soon. You think we should check up on him? No, I think he should be done about. There we go. Wow, it's all good. Comes with being a cocky cockney, mate.
McCarter kept the bridge crew at bay while Enciso began to power down the freighter's engines. From that observation point, the Cuban could see James and Hawkins now rounding up the stragglers. The terrorists had thought to put up a fight until they saw the British blockade of ships appear over the horizon on a direct course. A few shots from the heavy guns of one of the advance assault gunships were enough to make the terrorists reconsider their options. When McCarter arrived and told them to surrender, his British accent evident, the terrorist figured he was SAS and decided to surrender. That was okay. He had no problem letting the terrorists think they were with the British Special Air Service, one of the most elite fighting teams in the world, and Her Majesty's greatest option when a full military response wasn't in order. McCarter noticed one of the terrorists staring at him, and the Briton had to take a long, hard look before he realized he was staring into the eyes of Jabir Al-Warrick.
And what's with you, Al-Warrick? You have some kind of a problem.
So you know who I am. How nice. That must also mean that you cannot believe you have ended this war between us. It is only a beginning. Don't you see that? Why, even now, I think you didn't know that our freighter near the United States was able to successfully launch its missile.
You're full of shit, Jabir.
Oh yes, you know it's true. I would say that within approximately 10 minutes there will be widespread death in the city called Dallas. Yes, I would think many people will die.
Manning appeared at the door to the bridge.
What's he talking about?
He's claiming that they got a missile off and it's headed toward the Yanks. He says it's going to hit Dallas.
I can't believe it. Iron Man wouldn't let that happen.
Believe it. I've just checked the secure channel and it's true. They've scrambled the response team.
A pair of F-117 stealth fighters cruised above the Gulf of Mexico at 14,000 feet. One of the pilots, Major Janus Brest, considered his craft as he sped to intercept the missile headed toward Dallas. None of the radar systems in the immediate area would be able to track him unless especially equipped to do so. The external skin of the aircraft was predominantly made with aluminum, combined with a special boron polymer fiber known as fibaloy, and sheathed with tiles made from radar-absorbing material. The entire craft was controlled by a central computer brain and digital flight system manufactured by Lear Siegler. Brest had engaged his heads-up display, HUD, in preparation for intercepting the missile. Manufactured by Honeywell, the HUD consisted of a digital tactical display with color LCDs and a full three-dimensional mapping system. Despite public opinion, the F-117 wasn't strictly confined to a bombing role, although that was its primary purpose. It was a versatile aircraft, and Brest considered he was one of the lucky few able to pilot such a fantastic aircraft. His target was approaching. He flipped two switches to engage the Sidewinder AA missiles. He would have preferred a better missile for this kind of mission, but there hadn't been time. That's why there were two of them. The mission had to be accomplished. The entire country was counting on them.
Foxtrot 7 to Foxtrot 8, I have the bogey signal. You got the same over there?
That's a roger, 7. I'm marking at a height of 16,700. Point drop of 48 degrees. Speed is 800 knots.
It's an awfully sharp angle, 8.
I copy, 7, and I agree. Are you sure the computer can target this baby?
Foxtrot 8, you got a Kaiser. It's an affirmative.
The two planes accelerated to an attack speed and approach vector that would give them the best opportunity. The mechanical SPN-GEANS inertial navigation system provided a 4D view that ensured accuracy. The system would perform exactly as expected. Now all Brest had to do was to make sure he performed exactly as expected.
7 to 8, engage targeting beacon.
Brest switched over from ready to armed, and then set the HUD to begin a long-distance tracking. Of course, it wasn't really all that far away. Because the Sidewinders were primarily designed for shooting down other planes by locking on an infrared heat signature, they would have to come considerably closer to the target than was normally required. Each one of the missiles was extremely accurate, but they didn't have the same size window to play with this time around. Brest willed himself to relax. He'd just have to play it by ear and trust the computer would do the job.
Foxtrot 7, Foxtrot 8, I've got tone. Target's locked and...
There was silence, and Brest kept close to his wingman, his HUD getting closer. They needed confirmation quick, otherwise he wouldn't get a second chance. They could only allot one missile each for the shot, since once the firing mechanism engaged, the pursuing aircraft would lose hold and need at least 30 seconds to reset it. That could mean the difference between the success and failure of the mission.
Foxtrot 8 to 7, what's the story?
It's a miss. Lock on target and fire. Repeat, lock on target and fire.
Brest moved his fighter into position, watching carefully to ensure that Maple pulled back and didn't get caught in his jet wash. Sweat began to drip from his forehead, but he resisted the urge to take one hand from the targeting HUD to wipe at it. The sweatband and the helmet would prevent it from rolling into his eyes. Bress took a deep breath and waited patiently for his signal.
Come on, damn it. Just a little more. I've got home.
He flipped up the firing switch on the trigger next to the throttle. He depressed the button and held the stick steady, fighting any urge to move his eye away from the targeting sight.
It's away!
The light remained green in his scope, locked solid. Then a moment later, it winked out. Rest pulled his eye away from the targeting HUD and pulled up even as he saw the bright flash light up the night.
728! You hit it! You hit it!
Rest let out a sigh of relief. He had saved his country from his enemies and diverted a terrorist disaster. There wouldn't be any medals given out for it, at least nothing they could put in the official records. But as he turned his ship and headed for home, Bress thought that the pride of a job well done, as well as the number of lives he saved today, was worth more than any medal they could give him. As Carl Lyons exited the cab on one of the main thoroughfares through downtown Cancun, he checked either side of the street. He didn't seem to be under observation, and nobody appeared to be watching the door. In one respect, Consuela had done him a favor by offering a change of clothes. He would have stood out like a sore thumb dressed in the skin-tight black suit. Consuela had promised to burn the waterlogged uniform, and given her sensibilities, Lyons had no reason to disbelieve her. He tossed another 20 at Raul, shook the kid's hand, and watched him drive away. Raul had dropped the two terrorists at the Luna Verde Hacienda, a 20-story hotel in the downtown area. Without the kind of luck and cooperation he'd had up to this point, Lyons began to wonder if he would have ever caught up to them. Well, sometimes he just had to act on faith and go with his gut. Lyons entered the hotel and gave the lobby a quick inspection. The Luna Verde was a busy place this time of year, especially considering it was the tourist season. Then again, Lyons couldn't think of when it wasn't tourist season in that part of Mexico. The party never really stopped, and people from all over the world visited year-round. The ABLE team leader located one of the public phones and quickly dialed a number he had memorized. There was dead silence on the air for maybe 30 seconds as the call was routed through a series of cutouts. Then Aaron Kurtzman's voice sounded over the satellite encoded connection.
It's Iron Man.
Well, I am sure as hell glad to hear from you. The whole place is up in arms. We got it, pal. They got the missile.
I'm glad to hear it. Tell Hal I'm sorry.
Sorry for what? You guys did a great job.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the vote of enthusiasm, Bear. But before we break out the party hats, there's still a little unfinished business here.
Hey, are you okay? We got a message from Paul and Gadgets that you...
Look, I'm sure you did, but never mind that right now. I've tracked two of our pals on the freighter to the Luna Verde Hacienda in Cancun. Gadget said something to me earlier today that made me think that perhaps you can get into their system and check registrations.
Okay, no sweat, but what are you looking for exactly? Do you have a name?
No. I need all the names of anyone who checked in from 15 to 30 minutes ago, but no sooner or later than that window.
Well, let's see. Yeah, okay, I'm into their system. Hell, it didn't even put up a fight. All right. Looks like mostly Mr. and Mrs. this, Mr. and Mrs. that. Wait. Found something, I think. Party 2 checked in, both males, and the name of the guy who signed in was Zemed Dumham.
Zemed Dumham. Mahmoud Temez, spelled backward. What room is he in?
2014. Oh, I've just been informed that I'm supposed to give you a message from Barb.
What's that?
When you get done on this little personal vendetta, she wants you to get to the airport and meet up with Gadgets and Paul. Charlie's ready to fly you guys back here on the double. I think deep down she misses you.
Yeah, well, you can tell her I said this is no vendetta. Just some unfinished business with the Qibla.
Lyons stepped onto the 20th floor and quickly located the room number Kurtzman had given him. He thought at first about knocking, pretending to be room service or a hotel attendant, but changed his mind when he considered the risks. These weren't hoodlums or muggers. They were hardened terrorists who had done more than their fair share of deceiving an enemy. No, the best approach here was the direct approach. Lyons came through the doorway in a shoulder roll. The hotel suite was anything but, the only separate room being the bathroom. The main area had two double beds positioned on opposite walls. Lyons turned to see one of the terrorists sitting on the bed, a cigarette having just dropped from his open mouth. A glance told Lyons it wasn't Temez on the bed, which was too bad because his enemy actually went for a gun beneath his pillow. Lyons never gave him the chance. Blood sprayed onto the walls as the bullet went through the man's skull and blew his brains out. Lyons turned from the grisly scene and walked toward the closed bathroom door, listening carefully. It was the sound of running water, a shower going behind the bathroom door. Lyons marched to the door and stood to one side while turning the handle. It gave easily, and the door opened. The ABLE team leader ripped the curtain aside. He shoved the muzzle of the Colt Python between Temez's shoulder blades, then led him out of the room and down the hallway to the sign that indicated the exit led to a fire escape. He pushed through the inner hallway door and through an outer door that emerged onto the fire escape landing. Lyons knew he had less than a minute before his presence would attract attention. Fortunately, what he had in mind wouldn't take long.
Did you do it?
What? Who are you?
I'm asking the questions here. Did you do it?
Did I do what?
Did you launch the missile against my country?
Yes. It is for all the missiles that you have launched against my country. It is for the egregious sins and atrocities you have committed against the Iraqi people. It is for the murder of my fellow soldiers.
In case you haven't noticed, there's only one murderer in this crowd.
Yes, and it is you. You have killed my people with your poisonous Western ways. You have killed the tradition of the Islamic faith. You have killed the very children that would one day carry on the honor and loyalty of the Iraqi people. And it is you who are the murderer. And for your sins, Allah will punish you. He will send you into eternal damnation.
And I guess I'll see you there.
What? No!
Lyons had already turned away when Temez's body hit the pavement of the alley 20 stories below.
Stony Man Censor Sweep is a graphic audio production. Stony Man, The Executioner, and Mac Bolan are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2006, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2006, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Thomas Penny, Terrence Aselford, David Coyne, Ken Jackson, Christopher Graybill, Kate Torrey, Richard Rowan, Nanette Savard, Casey Jones, Jeff Baker, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Adapted for graphic audio and directed by Dan Smith. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Carlos Anderson, Dan Smith, and Temeskin Wubna. Graphic audio sound design by Carlos Anderson, Christian Parent, Dan Smith, and Temeskin Wubna. The Stony Man theme was composed by Mark Ashby. If you enjoyed Stony Man, be sure to look for Don Pendleton's Mac Bolan and The Executioner, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Mac Bolan number 103, Season of Slaughter.
Welcome to Washington Dulles International Airport.
Sir, we'd like to take a look inside your bags.
Go right ahead.
What do you have in these things?
Missile launchers.
Ladies and gentlemen,
May I have your undivided attention for a moment?
Gun!
He's gonna fire missiles at the jets moving to take off. If he hits them in the right spot, that aviation fuel is gonna light them up. Dulles is being turned into a hell zone. Someone took out air traffic control here. We already have a passenger jet full of casualties.
Just who are you?
Someone trying to prevent more tragedies.
Cut me down. 1,000 believers will take my place. Heaven shall be victorious.
You're right. Heaven will be victorious. But you're not invited to the celebration.
The climate heats up for the executioner in Mac Bolan number 103, Season of Slaughter.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.